www.thebeardedguy.com. This is episode 52. For this episode, I am going to revisit another dystopian classic, this time Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. On the last one, I went over 1984 by George Orwell, my favorite dystopian novel of all time, one of my favorites of all time, and the novel that is almost all the time mentioned along with 1984 as if they are contradictory or a pairing, or you know, maybe number one and number two on the top dystopian list. I mean, Brave New World is the other one. It's the, maybe not competitor is not the right word, but it's like, it is the other great dystopian novel. Everyone has their own opinions, but if you were to aggregate them or look at a top 10 list or votes, usually these two novels are one and two. You know, the order varies perhaps depending on where you're looking at it, or it's one and three or two and three or whatever. I mean, these two novels are always at the top, and they're very often compared with one another. So I decided to move on to this one for the next show here. And to go over my own thoughts, I read this book in college as well as 1984 for the same course, actually. I reread it again a couple weeks ago, took some notes on it, kind of similar to what I did with 1984. I wanted to reread it since it's been so long, and I wanted to also look at my old kind of class notes on it and my own old thoughts on it to see if maybe I've changed my view on it. And to some extent, I have. I think Brave New World stands up a little bit better in my mind than it did when I first read it 15 years ago for a couple reasons. I mean, things have changed in the last 15 years, but I think it's just more about me personally changing. So kind of a personal thing, but I'll try to keep, you know, let's keep these things general and try to talk about maybe more broadly instead of just me talking about all my own personal opinions. So anyway, for this episode, also no more beer. Tried doing that whole thing of local beers, trying to promote them, whatever. And basically there's just, I just don't really want to do it anymore because I noticed that obviously I drink if I'm drinking beer while I do this show, I have a tendency to belch or kind of have a little bit of gas, and I have to delete that out. It also kind of sometimes makes it a little bit tougher to stay on what I'm saying if I'm gulping that stuff down. So I prefer to kind of sip on something because, one, no gas. Two, you know, no belching or gas or anything. And two, like, it's just easier to pick up a glass, sip, put it back down, relax. You know, it's only a couple ounces. You know, right now I'm having some Maker's Mark over ice. I decided that was a better way to go. Plus, Thought Crime just does not have the audience to really justify getting any kind of sponsorship. I think any brewery, any person I talk to, they would not do any kind of sponsorship unless they saw, you know, the record, you know, traffic and whatnot. And really, if you go out there, most blogs don't have really any kind of sponsor unless you're, you know, Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, which is connected to the Wired magazine, or, you know, what have you. You know, you're attached to some larger corporate media property or media outlet, TV, magazine, whatever. We don't have any of that here. We just have my blog. So this is just me. We've had some co-hosts in the past, and we've kind of reached out a couple times to some people and really just have not been able to get a consistent kind of feel for that. So the whole sponsor thing, the beer thing, I do still drink beer plenty, and I all my opinions on everything on the beers presented here, I still think North Carolina is a great spot for craft beer. It's kind of like the beer, it's the beer center of the South. Not a lot of beer is made, and not as much drinking happens down here as you might think. And if it is, it's, you know, if you're in Kentucky and Tennessee, it's more of bourbon and whiskey. If you're in the Deep South, in Florida, you know, it's more of rum. And so beer, there is plenty of beer drinking down here, don't get me wrong, but I think it, in terms of producing beer and really it being a beer culture, like, say, Wisconsin, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, or Colorado, we don't really have that here in the South. I think North Carolina is really the only exception, and I did want to put a highlight on that, but I think that time has come to an end here. Unless I do get a call from a sponsor, or I do talk to one of the breweries and they do actually express some actual enthusiasm for this for that kind of thing, then maybe I'll change my mind. But otherwise, I've decided, yeah, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because I don't think anyone wants to hear me belching into the mic. So I'm drinking Maker's Mark over ice. And I actually have one of these ice trays that's shaped like the United States, so each ice cube is shaped like a state. I got it for Christmas. I don't. It's actually a really cool thing. It came with a couple whiskey glasses that had the U.S. Constitution along the side of the glass, the We the People, and then the first few lines of Article One. And then he, I also got along with that, you know, this ice tray of the United States. So every time I have a drink here, I put a couple states into my glass here. I think tonight I had Minnesota and New Mexico in my glass as ice cubes. So no particular reason I picked those two states. They just kind of came out of the mold easier than the other states. I'm not really sure what that means, but maybe because New Mexico is basically a square. You know, I don't know. But that's what's going on over here. So with that, I'm going to take a sip here, and then we'll get started. Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Published in 1932, written probably 1930, 1931, 1929, right around the time of the stock market crash and the very beginning of the Great Depression. Aldous Huxley was a British writer, so his experience with the Depression, there was a depression in England, there was an economic downturn, so he was having some experience of that of his own. It's not quite what the experience we had in the United States per se, but it was kind of a downtime. And around that time, another famous science fiction writer was talking about a very positive and happy future. You might have heard of him. His name is H.G. Wells. He wrote a few books about kind of predicting what he thinks the future would be like, and his versions were more utopian. In fact, one of the books is called A Modern Utopia. And so the idea for Brave New World actually began as a parody novel of these kind of positive utopias that Wells was putting out there that kind of weren't doing that well because nobody was really thinking the future was looking too bright in 1930. So it began as kind of just a parody, but then it actually transformed into a full novel, and that novel became Brave New World. It was published in 1932, like I said. That is a full 16, 17 years before 1984, before World War II, before anyone knew anything about, before the concentration camps, before Nazism was really seen as a great evil. And during 1932, Nazism was not really it wasn't the boogeyman yet. It was just another political party. And in fact, in the United States at least, and I think even in England, there was a lot of admirers of the Nazi Party and of Hitler's policies. Now, he was just getting into power at the time. I don't think he was actually the chancellor or the Fuhrer in 1931. I think he took power a year or two later after that, and the Reichstag got blown up. Even then, Hitler's just one of many European politicians, and the Nazi Party's just one of many European parties that maybe some people thought that National Socialism was the right move, wrong move. And in any event, communism was well established, but even that was still, the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin was still kind of getting his act together at that time. It was, you know, communism was a thing and had been around for about 15 years, 10, 15 years, I think. So that's the world that this book comes out of. It does not come out of a post-war world as 1984 did. And so it does not have the insight into communism, socialism, Nazism, fascism that Orwell had and a lot of writers have had since then. So that is the construct of where we're going here. In terms of methodology of dystopias, in terms of the nature of dystopias, Brave New World and 1984 are obviously very different. 1984 is basically kind of set on the Stalinist model of communism in the Soviet Union, the oppressive, rule by fear, totalitarianism, combined with a technology that allows you to monitor the entire population at all times, the telescreen. And in fact, the quote being is, if you want to know the future, it's a boot, you know, stomping on the face of stomping on a human face. That was their path to power. That is the dystopian world. The inner party, Big Brother, was all built on fear, creating fear, controlling truth, controlling information, total monitoring of the population, all for power's sake, for the power of the party. That was the purpose. Now, there was obviously the party wants order and stability. actually, they didn't really want that much stability. They were constantly at war, and they wanted everyone to think they were constantly at war. And so there was a little bit of tension that they wanted in the population as well. So that those are the kind of things that Big Brother wanted in his society, in his dystopian realm. Brave New World uses pleasure and feeds pleasure to its population to basically make them docile, receptive, to everything, basically making them as happy as possible so they don't question anything and they obey. They happily follow orders and act in harmony. And the structure of it is built on a few things. For one thing, there's the idea that of oneness, that everyone belongs to everyone else, the individual doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is being part of a group, part of the total, the world state or the society or whatever the broader territory is. But so you hear that in common, mentioned in the book several times, that nobody belongs to anyone else. No one is ever alone. In fact, the population is conditioned to hate being alone, and that they're discouraged from ever really being alone. When they go home after work, they're encouraged to go out to movies. They're expected to go out to movies. They're expected to go home with somebody and have sexual relations with all sorts of people. I mean, you are not to be alone at any time. You are always supposed to be part of everything. You are always around people, whether it's your coworkers, your neighbors, or whatever. Like, you're always with somebody, and you're always experiencing pleasure with them. It's always positive, whether it's taking pharmaceutical narcotics, soma, or sex hormone, chewing gum, or whatever. They have all these little things they give people. And of course, they set up these events, these pornographic movies. They set up these kind of orgy, they call them orgy porgies. I mean, all sorts of things to kind of make sure that what everyone wants is to get out of their house as soon as possible and go to one of these things and be around other people at all times and be part of a collective, happily, voluntarily, and to kind of discourage any kind of discord. And to do that, of course, they just drug them. I mean, that's really, they drug themselves, really. They choose to pop their own pills. The objective is order and harmony in a consumer mass production society, and also a society that is stable, keeps its population in check. And that's where the second part of it comes in, the genetic engineering and the population control system. Everyone is born in a fertility center, in vitro, and they're kept in vats or whatever. They're used by surrogates. They're genetically engineered to fall into five different groups, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. All of this is to keep the population under control and to make sure that each generation that is born, there are people that they fill into the proper caste or proper job, whatever their class is, epsilon, alpha, whatever. So they do that for stability, for the economy, even though they don't really use the word economy in the book. But it's for that. It's to keep balance. It's to keep the population under control, not to get overpopulation. They actually have these things they wear called Malthusian belts, which are basically where they keep their birth control and things like that. So you have population control, birth control. The state controls all of that. There are no mothers. There are no fathers. There's no families. So everyone belongs to everyone. There are no family units. It's just one big family, really. And then finally, it's the conditioning called hypnopedia. Basically, when the children are being developed in the fertility centers, they are being bombarded with, audio, subliminal, all sorts of different ways of conditioning. Little quotes and short little slogans are breached into their mind. Basically, it's almost like if you took kids today and put them in front of a TV to watch nothing but ads all day, every day for weeks. And then when they're born and when they're, toddlers and adolescents, they're also constantly being conditioned all the time so that the behaviors that are expected of them become second nature to them. It's been grilled into them. It's been also almost hypnotic, hence hypnopedia. So at every step, a person is being conditioned to fit the collective as best as possible with minimal disagreeableness, minimal conflict, tension, no tension whatsoever, and they have to gladly and happily give themselves over to this. And in the end, they all voluntarily do it. Even when you try to explain, even when it's trying to explain to them, what is being done here, they don't mind. In fact, they know where they come from. They know they all come from fertility centers. They know they don't have mothers and fathers. They know all this. They don't care. It's been the hypnopedia, the conditioning has all successfully gotten all of that out of them. And I mean, it's to the point where the idea of a mother or a father is offensive. It's perverse. The idea of a natural birth is perverse to them. It is no longer natural. I mean, they consider it weird. They consider it savage, uncivilized. And it's just been successfully done to them to the point where it's part of all their ideology. It's part of what they all think, thanks to this. You don't need fear. You don't need monitoring or surveillance or any of that stuff. You don't need a room 101 or any of the other things that Big Brother needed. Another way of saying like how it's contrasted with Big Brother is Brave New World relies on the kind of distraction and apathy of the populace, whereas Big Brother needs to overpower the populace through fear and force and whatnot. And there's a good quote here. It's from, you can get this on Wikipedia. I thought it was just a really cool quote, so I'm just going to read it right off of Wikipedia. It's from social media, social critic Neil Postman, as he was writing in one of his books about 1984 and Brave New World. And here's the quote that kind of best, I think, is really a great way of explaining kind of one of the key differences and the ones that are the most interesting to maybe us right now. Here goes. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy. I don't remember that. That's in the book, I guess. But really, like, what does that, I mean, which one of those two seems most like what we have today in the United States? I mean, that's what's striking to this. Like, if you want to compare which one are we most similar to, and I said in the 1984 one, like, there are some things that are happening in the United States that are within 1984 and are kind of to a far lesser extent. And in some cases, we are like, for example, the surveillance we're largely doing to ourselves. But, I mean, Orwell feared, let's just go through these, the most extreme ones. Orwell feared we would ban books. We're not banning books in the United States, or in the Western world for that matter. We don't ban books. It's still, that practice is still considered repugnant. Some churches may do it, some communities may try to do it, but as a country and as a whole, there's not a lot of support for that practice. Huxley, meanwhile, thought there would be no reason to ban a book because nobody would want to read one. And I think that kind of goes to the fact that how much do Americans really read these days? And what do we read for that matter? You know, how many books, you know, I mean, who's going to sit down and read a whole book, you know? God forbid. We get them on audio, which I guess is sort of the same thing. But most people just hardly read at all. They just watch TV, and TV is not equivalent of a book. Next one, Orwell feared deprivation of information. Basically, information would be concealed of us. Obviously, that is not the case now. We have the internet. The ability to block information from American consumers is almost impossible. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. Controlling information, everyone's paranoid about it, but let's be honest. We have countless sources of information, countless. And for the state to come in and control them all, first of all, the backlash and the reaction would be enormous. Secondly, it would be extremely difficult for them to succeed. And thirdly, I mean, it's just not being done because there's no point. There's no momentum to do that. Now, there are some things like the fairness doctrine for being applied to the internet, you know, trying to give each side kind of equal time. But other than that, we don't really have that. That practice is also still considered repugnant. Now, Huxley feared that there'd be so much information we'd be reduced to passivity and egotism. That's basically true now. We have people walking around, well, that's a bad way to say it. everyone has access to the most information that any human has ever had access to since the beginning of time. Everyone has access to the internet in some way or another. They may not have it in their house, but they have access. They can go somewhere and get access to all the information they could ever want, and it's not that expensive. Comparatively speaking, the books you'd have to buy in the 60s and 70s to equal the information you can get for free on the internet, Wikipedia, just for one, that's really where we are. And what is the information out there? What are we reading? I mean, there's how much bullshit information is. And I'm not just talking fake news. I mean, just magazines about celebrities, magazines about movies and TV shows, commentaries on TV shows, Twitter feeds. How much of that? I mean, just we're drowned in information. There's so much out there to the point where I know people that will just simply read headlines now. And as Huxley said, truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. I think that is a better description of what's happening now than Orwell's kind of the Ministry of Truth. But the thing is, I think what Huxley captures, and I think this is the thing I'm appreciating now, is Huxley captures this as a voluntary act. Everyone in Brave New World, in the civilized part of England in this book, knows about all this. None of this is secret. They don't read books. They choose not to read books. They know they're not reading books. They can probably go find them if they wanted to, but there's no interest in them. I think the controller mentions that we don't teach them Shakespeare or whatever, but he never tells them that we hide it from them. Like, necessarily. They're not banned. They're not destroyed. Some of this information does exist. They do go, like, for example, in the book, Bernard and Lenina go to the Savage Lands where they could learn everything they'd want to learn about religion, Christianity, but they're repulsed by it. And they come back, and it's just kind of a holiday thing you do, you know, to go see the old Wild West, you know, New Mexico reservation, where they meet John the Savage. That's really... So the information is there. They just don't want to find it. They're too busy, you know, fucking each other, taking Soma, seeing movies that make your chairs vibrate, you know, taking these sex hormone chewing gum, eating, you know, just decadent food. So really, it's a voluntary act. And kind of my point in the last podcast about 1984 is that a lot of the methods that Big Brother used in 1984 to control the population, we were doing to ourselves. And I think Brave New World captures different methods of control that we are also doing to ourselves. I think a good part of American culture, and again, I'll say this in every podcast, I can only speak to American culture because I'm an American. I've not been abroad in some time, so I cannot speak to other whatever's going on. But yeah, Huxley feared we'd become a trivial culture. I think that has largely taken place. Now, is the entire culture trivial? No. I mean, American culture is really basically an amalgamation of about 12 or 13 or 14 subcultures, and maybe a couple of those in that group of a dozen or 14 have become largely trivial. I mean, the obsession with sex appeal in music videos, the obsession with celebrities, the absolutely banal conversations that happen on Twitter sometimes regarding talking of trash, the egotism that everyone seems to practice. They're so worried about what other people say about them. They're so worried about talking behind one's back, talking about trash. They like to feel better about themselves by seeing other people act foolish on TV, you know, on daytime shows, or, you know, the Dr. Phil guest said, "Cash me out back, how about that?" You know, stuff like that. These stupidity, ignorance, and just depravity are like celebrated or joked at. I mean, there's nothing, and it is funny. I mean, a lot of these memes are funny, but it's one thing to laugh at them and kind of say, but laugh at them and then almost practice these things. I can think of a lot of comedians back when I was growing up in the 90s and 2000s. I mean, most comedians are not exactly amazing people, and they'll tell you that in their stand-up. They're usually lazy. They're usually not very happy. They're terrible at relationships, generally. And they have this dark side of, you know, they have usually this really dark, twisted sense of humor, or they can see the humor in a lot of things, largely because they've just seen a lot of things. And, you know, they want to share their kind of experience. So they're usually up there self-deprecating and whatever. Not all of them, but a good number of them are basically talking about their own failings. and people cheer. People laugh. I mean, it's gotten to the point where you almost glorify it. Failings in the way of basically just only caring about consuming distraction entertainment and not actually accomplishing anything. Not that they're, you know, criminals. You know, basically they're admitting that they don't do anything. They're lazy. All they give a shit about is sex and alcohol and whatever, and they don't think anything else matters. They poke fun at family. They poke fun at whatever. Anything that Orwell and Huxley would probably consider culture, you know, legitimate culture, legitimate achievement of bettering yourself. For a lot of comedians and a lot of people these movies that these comedians often get together with writers and make these movies, they're glorifying a lack of it. So I've seen it myself because I've seen a lot of movies where, I mean, they're just all, I mean, Seth Rogen, who I like Seth Rogen, he's a funny guy, but I mean, a lot of his movies are about basically fuck-ups who have no idea what they're doing. I mean, that's basically the punchline of all of his movies. At the end of the movie, he finally gets his shit together. I mean, that's the nice thing about Seth Rogen, I guess. But a lot of the characters in his movies, and in some of the cases, they're just all fuck-ups. Adam Sandler, most of his movies, he's a fuck-up. Can't think of a few other... Will Ferrell is usually some bombastic, kind of barely functioning adult. He's like a giant child most of the time in his movies. So, I mean, that's what you're kind of seeing, just giant children that are just unable to cope with a lot of what's out there when you have to adult, and they just simply find a way not to. The book also kind of glorifies Henry Ford. I mean, the way they count years is after Ford, AF. Instead of saying by God, they usually say by Ford or my Ford or Ford help you. Really, I mean, It's Ford's kind of commitment to the assembly line, which was kind of the huge thing in the 20s and 30s of mass production, homogeneity, predictability, and basically creating consumer goods that are disposable, basically that have to be replaced every few years. That's what the business model pretends, and that's what business models are now. I mean, most electronic equipment has almost planned obsolescence built into them. They're only meant to last 3 to 5 years before the new replacement has to be purchased. Anyone who has a phone knows what I'm talking about. Or if you have a console or a computer, for example, the computer and the software you have after a few years, it starts to get buggy and worse and worse. And unless you're in the industry and you know how to work around that, I mean, after about 5 or 6 years of owning any kind of sophisticated piece of electronic equipment, you kind of throw your hands and you're like, fuck it, I'll just buy a new one. This thing is just getting old and buggy. I don't know how to fix it. I don't even know who to pay to fix it. Sometimes it's not even fixable. You just need a new hard drive. You need a faster processor or whatever. So it's kind of what we do now. It's kind of what Henry Ford put out there and kind of the mass production of, in this case, you know, in Brave New World, in this dystopian society, it's the mass production of people and the homogeneity of it. The only real distinctions between people are whether you are in one of the five castes, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and that determines what traits you have. And the weird thing is about these castes is the higher castes are kind of conditioned to not want to be the lower caste. It's kind of like this classism that's conditioned into them. I thought that was interesting. I wasn't sure how that would really work, because if you're trying to create a society with no tension, I don't know if you can really put any kind of classist notions in there. They all acknowledge that deltas and epsilons are important to the functioning of a society. And of course, the deltas and epsilons are too stupid to have any kind of animosity towards the higher ups. So I'm not sure why the higher stratums, the alphas and betas, would have this conditioning. Huxley, I think, explained a little bit of it in the book. I just didn't find it very satisfactory. But that's like the only real kind of distinctions between people. And they all seem to have similar, you know, names and everything. I mean, there's just not much. The culture is very homogeneous. The people are very homogeneous. The society is. They all basically see the same movies, do the same things. Like I said, they consider themselves a one, a collective. No families, no tribes, clans. No subcultures, there's no movements, there's no kind of identifying features other than whether you're an alpha, a beta, and, you know, whatever your job title is. The assembly line of people. It's basically what the first few chapters are. And you know, for those of us who are of more of a classic liberal or libertarian lean and believe in individual freedom and liberty and all that stuff, I mean, that's, it's repulsive. It's terrifying. All right. I'm going to go back really quick to these, like, the feelies, the orgy porgies, the bumbleberry pops, the sex hormone chewing gum, the soma, and all these things. These are, in the way the book describes them, these are like kind of all the kind of pleasures and kind of entertainment and distraction that we have now kind of kicked up a notch. And it's the ways that we kind of distract ourselves. And it really, the interesting thing is why maybe Brave New World maybe not have survived that well, but is maybe becoming more relevant now, is that this was written before the drug epidemics of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where these drugs, you know, narcotics were being used for people to escape in the similar manner as soma, and they had devastating side effects. Now, in the book, soma has no side effects. In fact, Linda, the woman who is from the civilized part of England and goes to the reservation and is stuck there, I mean, she recalls, you know, she has, in order to have the same experience as soma, she has to take mescal or peyote, and she hates it because there's all sorts of side effects. She feels like crap afterwards. Soma has been perfected to where it has no side effects. It gives you the high, it gives you the euphoria, it gives you the hallucinations, it puts you out in a way that, you know, our current drugs do, but without the side effects, and it allows them person to be functional once they come out of it. Now, there, from what we know about these things, it's kind of you have to ration it, and it sounds like in the book, as I recall, soma is rationed. But I mean, with something like that, you know, it's hard. It's our experiences in the latter part of the 20th century would say, I don't know if you could really. I mean, the desire, the will to have more soma, to want to experience that all the time. I mean, people might be compelled to act criminally to get more, to steal it, just as they steal to get money for drugs or whatever, like they do all the time now. So I think soma would have to be crafted in a way that, or people would have to be conditioned in a way that once they're done with their soma, they can go back to work, and then they can come back out of it. I mean, I think perhaps the reason it works so well is that they're allowed to take soma after every day. So it's not like a weekend thing. It's not like it's being harshly rationed. They're given plenty without them losing their functionality. But it's, again, it's hard to see people giving people something that is mind-altering and then expect them to also be productive citizens and have it, you know, have the half-life of the drug be out of your system and have no side effects. So that was kind of interesting. The other thing, I mean, the orgy porgies, basically encouraging promiscuous sex all the time, you know. Men have no problem finding women to have sex with. Everyone's attractive. Everyone's engineered to be beautiful. Women are encouraged to be beautiful and be promiscuous and sleep around and to enjoy sex as much as men do. You would imagine something like that would just require an absolute transformation of not just the culture, but, you know, basic biology. And of course, that's part of this. So it's really, and there's some books that are out there that argue that, like, the most, and I think Margaret Atwood touched on this in her book Oryx and Crake, that one of the most destructive instinctual drives in humanity is the male sex drive. It is constant. It drives us towards aggression. It's built on testosterone, and it's often leads to, you know, the pursuit of sex or the pursuit of females is usually the motivation for murder or violence in a lot of cases. I mean, it's one of the most common motives for murder, jealousy, you know, things like that. So to basically provide a full outlet for that, basically everywhere you go, you can find a woman. It's not that, you know, finding a date, and it's not even a date. There's no relationships. There's no marriage. The only reason you spend any time with women or spend any time with men is to have sex with them or to go to a movie or whatever. It's expected. I mean, to take someone to that level, to take a whole group of people to that level, to kind of allow their bodies to be used like that. I mean, again, a lot of pharmaceuticals, conditioning, genetic engineering, you probably, with enough work, I guess, you know, you could see a future where you do that. And you're doing that to kind of eliminate that tension and that drive. But it seems like you'd have to change a lot of things to make that work. A lot. Genetically, culturally, biologically, pharmaceutical. I mean, there's just so many things that human sexuality is built on that leads to, you know, coupling, jealousy, aggression, you know. And to say nothing of the fact, you know, having an orgasm, not having an orgasm, enjoying sex, not enjoying sex, you know, the groping and fondling that happens in this novel that is like welcome, is expected. I mean, these are all things that are just, they're all, it's not, you can't just, you know, switch a few genes to make that happen. But this is a dystopia. This is 600 years in the future. And it's kind of an essential element to keeping people happy. Because, you know, what is one of the greatest experiences people have? It's sex. So if you can give it to them at a plenty rate, along with drugs, soma, food, you know, great food, great movies, you know, dumb movies. Basically, the movies are all described like they're basically blockbuster action movies. There's like no plot. When John the Savage, the guy from the reservation, sees the movies, he's comparing them to Shakespeare, and he finds them stupid and pointless. And most of the alphas like that are around, specifically the controller and Bernard, agree. They know they're stupid, but they like them anyway. I feel the same way. I love watching smart movies. I love watching, you know, books, and I love reading books that are, you know, kind of tough reads here and there. I also watch The Avengers. I went out and watched Ghost in the Shell. I watched King Kong. I know they're stupid, but like it's kind of a great period of where you turn your mind off and for 2 hours you do that. So I'm guilty of it, just like everyone else, to go to these things and experience like a visual, you know, onslaught, knowing there's no real kind of artistic value in what you're seeing. It's just explosions, fast cars, beautiful women, whatever. From a psychology standpoint, you would say the harmony and the order of the Brave New World society is built on Sigmund Freud's will to pleasure. Whereas 1984's Big Brother, his order is everything he does is based on the Nietzsche's will to power. And it's like these two conflicting psychologies of how you reach, you know, total control and total domination in a world, you know, maybe not a world state, but a super state. A world state in Brave New World, but it's a super state in 1984. And it's kind of cool that it's interesting that they took two very distinctive psychological theories, one Nietzsche, one Freud, on the matter, and managed to build dystopias of two very distinctive dystopias built on those two psychological principles. There was an interesting similarity between these two books, and it was the control of history, or the management of history. In 1984, history had to be consistent with whatever Big Brother said. So history was always being altered. The Ministry of Truth was basically altering history to fit whatever the party needed. And everyone was to remember, not really remember on their own what happened back in the day. They were to accept whatever was told to them as, this is what happened in history. We've always been at war with East Asia. We didn't just switch sides. And there's kind of like this, nobody remembers what the old days are like. And in fact, Winston Smith tries to find an old man and ask him what life was like before Big Brother and before the party. And he struggles to find anyone that'll really describe it. They only remember bits and pieces. You know, the old man he speaks to is too drunk and too out of it to give him any real thing. He just talks about top hats. And in Brave New World, Controller says, you know, when John the Savage and Controller are discussing history, and they discuss Shakespeare, Controller says, nobody wants to read Shakespeare, and we don't encourage it. We don't really give it to them. It's like, why not? It's like, it's too old. It's like, what do you mean it's too old? Like, we don't value old things. We only value new things. We don't want, you know, talk about like those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it kind of scenario here. In both of these dystopias, they just both manipulate history one way or another. One just refuses to remember it and only wants to remember recent history. And it makes no attempt to teach people history. The other changes history to suit whatever their contemporary needs are. And I'm a believer that if you don't know history, you are just going to simply make the same mistakes your ancestors did, and no progress will be made. So the fact that two dystopias have that element of, you know, not respecting history in them, I thought was very fascinating. And one of the unusual similarities, not direct similarity, but one of the unusual kind of similarities that these two dystopias have, even though in most other cases they're very distinct from one another. The other mantra of the controller, or the Brave New World state, is this, you know, truth does not bring happiness. Truth brings misery. Knowledge brings mystery. Ignorance is bliss. It is what every citizen, whether they're an alpha or epsilon, knows instinctually thanks to their conditioning and their breeding. They will only know what they need to know to do their job, and that's it. Everything else is just distraction, entertainment, fun. You know, their attention spans are probably very short. And, you know, they're just worried about the next night, who they're going to sleep with the next night, what they're going to do in the next week, you know, whatever their fun thing is doing. They don't really care about, they don't give any thought to what's going on in the world. They have no families to take care of, no careers, no purpose, other than to continue having fun. So there's no pursuit of knowledge. There's no science. There's no history. There's no pursuit of truth. Truth doesn't really matter. And it's the same thing in Oceania in 1984. Truth is whatever Big Brother says it is. But Winston Smith is constantly pursuing it in 1984 because he needs to know what really happened in the past and what the truth is. He can't, and it matters to him who they're at war with and that the country they're at war with changed. Like, he wants to know the truth. He can't help it. He cannot simply accept what Big Brother is putting, the bullshit that's being put out there. In Brave New World, John the Savage wants to know the truth of things, but he's obviously kind of a miserable guy. And they say, look, they don't need to know that they're being enslaved to Soma. In fact, they might actually know it. It doesn't matter. They don't need to know any more than that, and they don't care to know it. Truth, knowledge, science, those bring misery. Ignorance is bliss. And I have to say, there are times in my life where I agree with that adage of learning something about, you know, professionally, intellectually, learning something about somebody close to me has not brought, knowing something and becoming more familiar and mastering something has not always brought me happiness. And in fact, it has brought, you know, internal turmoil, conflict, you know, me doubting myself, questioning my own principles, questioning what I've done in the past. You know, it makes you doubt that you truly understand the world around you. And then you start, you know, the self-doubt kind of grows from there, and you're just, you know, and learning the truth of somebody, when you learn somebody you admire is a flawed person, you know, such as learning that your parents are human, learning that your idol is a fraud, things like that. You know, truth can often bring misery. You know, knowledge and science can often not bring the improvements. You know, scientific innovations sometimes are painful at first, and sometimes don't bring the great changes you want to. That, you know, eventually they do bring progress, but sometimes it's pretty painful. But is knowledge the source of suffering? Absolutely not. Science, truth, knowledge, religion, which is another thing that Controller mentions. You know, they seem to suggest abolishing these things would abolish suffering. That is not the case at all. What ended suffering was the fact that was all the things I mentioned, the genetic engineering, the conditioning, the hypnosis, the soma, the orgy porgies, you know, that stuff was replaced, gave, you know, a massive amounts of pleasure to people and distraction from the things that would create discomfort, pain, and suffering. Religion, the book covers religion quite a bit and simply says that it's no longer necessary. You don't need God anymore. You know, religion was there to explain suffering and to explain the world. And to explain why things, you know, why, you know, so the controller even explains that God is essentially obsolete in civilization. So why, it's not that the people don't believe in God or they're atheists anymore. They just don't give any thought to it because they don't see any need for God. In fact, let me find the quote. All right, I think I got it right here. They're arguing about God. Their argument, the controller and John the Savage are arguing towards the end of the book about the merits of their society. The controller's indulging. Of course, the controller is well-educated. He's older. He knows everything about his side of it, and he's thought about these things already, but he's chosen to be a controller anyway. So this is This is, first of all, this is John the Savage. He asks, but God's the reason for everything noble and fine and heroic. If you had a God, Mustafa Mon, the controller, says, my dear young friend, civilization has absolutely no need of nobility or heroism. These things are symptoms of political inefficiency. In a properly organized society like ours, nobody has any opportunities for being noble or heroic. Conditions have got to be thoroughly unstable before the occasion can arise. Where there are wars, where there are divided allegiances, where there are temptations to be resisted, objects of love to be fought for or defended, there, obviously, nobility and heroism have some sense. But there aren't any wars nowadays. The greatest care is taken to prevent you from loving anyone too much. There's no such thing as a divided allegiance. You're so conditioned that you can't help doing what you ought to do. And what you ought to do is, on the whole, so pleasant, so many of natural impulses are allowed at free play that there really aren't any temptations to resist. Here he's basically saying there's no need for God. There's no need for heroism, nobility, all the things, the principles, the Ten Commandments, no longer are necessary, because all the things those are there to imbue in humanity, humanity no longer needs them. I'm sure there's some people listening that would love to live in a world free of religion and free of those kind of things. And Huxley offers this as one way you could do away with religion and make it obsolete. Science is the other way, basically explaining away all the things that religion used to explain to people by providing, you know, empirical evidence. But even in the modern era, there's still plenty of people that are educated in science that still believe in God and still believe in some, what some might call superstitions or faith or whatever. So even as science continues to progress, people would argue eventually religion will disappear because it can't, all the questions that it answered will soon be answered by science. So that's one other way. But Huxley provides this other way of basically taking away all the societal functions of religion and God and whatever, and simply says, when would those commandments come into play? Thou shalt not kill? Nobody has any reason to kill anyone. Thou shalt not steal? Nobody is in want of anything. Why would they steal? They would never steal. No one steals. You know, these commandments, you can write them down and say don't do them, and everyone kind of look at them and be like, why would you have to write that down? Nobody does that. It's like telling everyone don't burn down orphanages. Do you have to tell people that? No. Because only the most deprived mind would even come up with that idea. We don't teach our kids not to burn down orphanages. We don't spend a lot of time on that particular lesson. So we don't really have to. And that's in our example. In his example, he can run through the Ten Commandments, the controller could, and simply say, we don't need any of them. Nobody does those things. Why would we need commandments for things nobody does anyway? We've already found a way to prevent them from doing that. We don't need God to command them otherwise. And we don't need to explain the universe and creation to them because they don't care. They're too distracted to think about those things. Does this sound familiar? How many conversations have you had with friends or acquaintances about these big questions? And how often do they kind of, in a way, admit they don't really think about them? Or they haven't thought it through, or they just don't know? They don't know because they may just be being honest that they've thought about it a lot and they just have not come to an answer. But I think there's plenty of people in my family and in my circle of friends and people I've met that I know for a fact that they just don't think about it. And that's in, 2017. This is not Brave New World. We don't have soma. We don't have orgies. We don't have the conditioning yet. So we already have a little bit of this, if you can distract people to the point of not thinking about these big questions and therefore not thinking about God or the lack of God or gods, whatever it is. In the end, Brave New World, the whole system is built on technology reshaping human nature to be pliable, harmonious, ordered, functional, efficient, and to prevent, any kind of rebellion or tension. These people are kept happy all the time. They're conditioned to be happy. They're conditioned to not venture towards things that can cause tension, can cause stress, misery. From the very start, they're taught to avoid things. And really what I think about, what do we have today that is similar to this kind of practice? I think I already talked about it before already, but here's a few other things. For example, I mean, we've had alcohol for a long time. We have drugs. Our experience with illegal drugs and recreational drugs has been not what happens in Brave New World. In order to really get there, to have something like Soma, we would have to engineer it to maximize its euphoric effect and minimize its side effects and shorten its half-life. And that basically comes down to designer drugs. Starting to customize, you know, natural or synthetic substances that we've been using for centuries into something that won't put you in rehab, won't, you know, you can't OD on, and will give you that big high without turning you into a total, you know, drooling mess. And you see that with designer drugs. You've seen kind of this in the electronic music scene and some kind of clubs where they take ecstasy or designer drugs or things like that that are designed to kind of maximize the experience and in some ways try to cut back on some of the, you know, the nasty side effects of, you know, cocaine, crack use, heroin, not be addictive and not, you know, turn you into a total mess. Some people argue that prescription drugs are also, pharmaceutical companies are already working on these kind of things, but for example, painkillers are highly addictive and turn you into a wreck. So they're not exactly creating recreational drugs. Their drugs are basically to solve one particular symptom or problem, and they don't really give a shit about anything else. None of their drugs really create much of any euphoria or positive, and they have plenty of side effects. So really where you would find what Soma would be, you know, in the recreational drug industry trying to create new designer drugs. In terms of the orgies, I mean, a lot of these subcultures where, you know, sexual promiscuity and exploration are encouraged, are welcome, there's non-judgmental. We already kind of have that already. Now, is it to the point where men and women are expected to sleep with each other every night? Like, that's unusual. That still, you know, it's kind of an ideal that I think the hippies had in the 60s about free love and whatnot. And so it has kind of appeared from time to time in the U.S., but there's just still human nature, and there's still just a lot of things that make that difficult to gain traction. And, you know, temptation and jealousy still exist, even when culturally everyone's saying that, you know, everyone should be able to sleep with everyone regardless, and no consequences, no strings attached. In theory, that is already out there. In practice, it just doesn't seem to spread, and is just not that common. You do have, like, swinger clubs. You have, you know, some open marriages, quote unquote. I mean, they're out there, but maybe they're getting a little bit more common than they used to, but they're not widespread, and they come with a host of problems. They don't always work out the way, you know, the people that do it think it will. In terms of the feelies, the movies, the kind of sensory overload of tactile and visual and audio, we're pretty far along on that. CGI, the movies we watch are visually just amazing. The sound is amazing. The tactile experience, we're not quite there yet. But of course, you know, the chewing gum that makes you kind of the sex hormone chewing gum. We don't really have things like that yet, but we're getting closer and closer. So some of these things we already have out there. The question is, these things that are out there, like so we have like some of the narcotics and some of those things already. We're pretty far off on a few others, but some of it's there. Do we have the hypnopedia and conditioning? Well, you could call advertising and all the advertising that we see on TV and the ads on the internet and all the things we're bombarded with is a kind of a form of hypnopedia, but I mean, we're not a very homogenous society. We're not very uniform. And if we are being conditioned, we're not being conditioned very well, because there's just so much diversity and there's so many differing opinions and there's still so much conflict and tension and division among us that if there is any of that going on, it's not working. History. Yeah, we Americans really don't have a very good knowledge of history or geography. Some do, not everyone, but so there's that. We don't have genetic engineering. We don't have a genetic caste system. We do have economic inequality and income inequality, but we don't have anything like that. Some people are very concerned with overpopulation, but I think a lot of the predictions, in particular Huxley and Thomas Malthus and a lot of these thinkers in the 19th and 20th century thought that this planet could only support 3 billion people have been proven wrong. And the reason being technology. We're able to we can produce a lot more food with the land given than they ever thought possible, thanks to pesticides, herbicides, all sorts of other technologies that allow us to very efficiently and effectively produce a ton of food with not a lot of land. And that's now, is this planet crowded? Yes, but are we on the verge of some sort of Malthusian disaster? I mean, they keep saying that. I mean, they time and time again, they keep predicting doom because of that. And time again, we cross another population milestone without it really happening. People are largely starving in the world, not really because of shortage of food being produced in the world, but it's more of the distribution and the getting it to them. The U.S. produces a shit ton of food. We throw away a lot of food. If we could get it to the famines of Africa or Asia effectively, there would be no famine. There's plenty of food being produced on this planet. It just does not get to everyone equally. We don't have a world state. We don't have a homogeneous society as or the Henry Ford or the Fordist concept of mass-producing humans or... we are a consumer. I mean, a lot of Americans are basically obsessed with consumerism, of buying the next big thing, of upgrading when they can, getting the nicer car when they can afford it, getting the bigger house when they can afford it, status symbols, and consumption. So a lot of people are kind of on that treadmill already. And so I think you can check that box in terms of Brave New World. But like I said, I just ran through these four or five other things. We're pretty far off. Huxley, I think, in one of his interviews said that he thought it would happen in, you know, 6 centuries, and he thinks like it's happening now. Like, I was right. I just disagree with him. I think that just like in 1984, there are elements of his dystopia that are present now, and maybe they've always kind of been present to some extent, but maybe they're becoming more prominent now. But there are just a lot of things in his dystopian vision that we're nowhere near achieving yet. And there's still a lot of people that don't fit this mold. I kind of rapped on Americans and for 40% of Americans not voting, not caring what's going on in the political system, kind of giving away their liberty and not really giving a shit about the freedoms and things that are going on that impact their lives, but they just don't seem to give a shit. Or they feel like they have no impact on it, or they're more concerned with, you know, how they're going to pay for the case of beer or the bag of weed they're going to, you know, smoke over the weekend. I don't know. There is some of that kind of apathy and lackadaisicalness and this inability to connect with what's going on around them. And so that's true. It's just, but it's not everyone. There are still highly educated and engaged people in the U.S. There are some people that appreciate history and know history. There are a lot of people that don't like to take drugs, whether they're illegal or legal. A lot of people are into healthy living. They, you know, the popularity of Spartan races and things like that, and the kind of the health thing, you know, with genetically modified foods and trying to decrease the amount of synthetics they take. There is a culture, a part of our culture that is in total rejection of Huxley's dystopian vision. They don't like to take drugs unless they have to. They don't go out and see these movies, and a lot of people are actually starting to not get cable. They don't consume these distractions at a high rate. A lot more people do than don't, but my point is that we are not homogenous, and that there's a lot of people that simply are not doing these things, are rejected, even though they're out there, they're not doing these things, and they don't want to be distracted. They do want to pursue knowledge and science and truth and etc. So unless you find a way to breed them out and get your genetics engineering system in the works, we are not close to a Brave New World. There is a subpopulation of the Western societies, in the U.S. I can speak more to, that maybe are very close to getting there and share a lot in common with Huxley's vision. But it's not the whole country. I'm not even sure it's a majority. And I'm not even sure it's growing at much of a high pace. Maybe it is, but it's just not. There's just still plenty of people out there that are more like John the Savage than they are, you know, Lenina or Bernard, or, well, not Bernard, Lenina or Watson or what have you. So, but both, you know, both dystopias, George Orwell's and Huxley's, take things that are kind of around already and take them to their logical conclusion if we went in one direction or the other. In Orwell's case, it was communism and socialism. If we took it all the way to its end result, we would end up with Stalin or Mao or Kim Jong-il. That was his warning, and he took it to an extreme. And arguably, there's some things in the end, 1984, and a lot of the communist regimes, Soviet Union did collapse, and a lot of these, and Mao's China is not what it was. It's not. It's looking less and less like 1984. But it was a valid warning because it did happen. Societies did emerge that looked very, very similar to 1984. Huxley's vision is in the opposite direction. It's all built on the will to pleasure. And we're kind of seeing some of this indulgent, you know, opulence and this, I don't care, I just want to, you know, drink and fuck my way through the rest of my life and let somebody else take care of everything else. I don't care. As long as you take care of those things, I won't cause any trouble. That's already out there right now. Some of that already exists now, and Huxley kind of took it to its extreme conclusion. And both are classics. Both should be read by everyone. 1984 is still, I think, a little bit more influential on me than Brave New World. Brave New World, I think, relies on a lot of world building and a lot of futuristic developments, whereas 1984 doesn't. It only really relies on two or three developments, the telescreen being the big one. So I think that's why I personally give my nod to 1984. But both are definitely worth reading. And should be read by everyone. It should be required reading in high school and college, and adults should reread it at some point in their lives. One of the silly things about Brave New World, I'll say real quick and then I'm going to finish here, is the character names are all kind of brought out of great thinkers and historical figures of Huxley's time. One of the main characters, Bernard Marx, was named, the name is from George Bernard Shaw, a major thinker of the 19th, 20th century, and of course Karl Marx. Henry Foster is a take on, obviously kind of a variation of Henry Ford. Lenina Crown, at least what I'm reading here, is that Lenina comes from Vladimir Lenin. Fanny Crown comes from Fanny Kaplan, a famous attempted assassin of Lenin. Let's see, Benito Hoover is Benito Mussolini and Herbert Hoover. I mean, all these names seem like they come from historical figures of his time. Darwin Bonaparte, Herbert Bakunin is Herbert Spencer and Mikhail Bakunin. Mustafa Mond, the controller, is Mustafa Kemal Ataturk and Sir Alfred Mond. And there's a bunch of others here. John the Savage, well, that's just like the noble savage. They keep calling him Savage, but he's like the noble savage. You know, there's, even though he's a technically a backwards, uncivilized person, he's got principles, and he's a kind of the noble, kind of the way the Sioux are portrayed in Dances with Wolves, or the Na'vi in Avatar. There's like kind of, even though they're primitive by technological and cultural scales to some extent, maybe not cultural, let's just say technology, there's something about them that's noble and elegant, and we can learn something from them, is kind of the point of some of these movies. And I think John the Savage is the same thing. So, all right, that is it. I'm going to finish there. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Thought Crime, and until next time.